If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blah Blah Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Utter deep breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grime America Show. Coming at you this week with Monk Monroe, talking about all sorts.
Monroe. I put it right in the notes. I phonetically spelled it out in the notes too, just in case for myself.
I don't have the notes open. Monk Monroe. So good chat. If people want to skip ahead, they can always jump to the timestamp in the show notes. Of course, we've got everybody's favorite podcaster, Graham the Catman Dunlop.
Yeah, this is going to be an awesome app. This was a fantastic app. I mean, his story is amazing. It's about the revelation, a novel of interstellar contact. It's pretty fascinating, especially, you know, today with everything going on today. All the alien memes.
It's a good chat with the monk. He's, he's like supposed to be dead, right?
A couple times, I think.
A couple times.
Yeah.
So you gotta respect that at least a little bit. And then of course we're under a month away. I mean, man, this trip's coming up quick. It's like I'm barely settling back in from Easter Island. It's time to go again. But we do have a few spots left for that trip coming up right away with Dave Matheson, Brandon Powell, and of course now Dan Richards, Dan the D-Dunker, is coming as well to the event. So almost a new headliner is coming along that you can come and hang out with for a couple of days and see the Serpent Mound on the solstice.
Well, and so, your presentation too, which is noon on the Sunday, right? I think Sunday the 21st at noon is your presentation.
Noon on Sunday the 21st. Yeah, yep, correct.
And what's yours called? Adam and Eve and the Great Reset?
Yes. It's nice. Pretty well done, too.
Nice.
I got to go through it a couple times and just clean up the notes, make sure I'm happy with them.
Yeah.
But the slides are done and in order.
That's good.
There's a lot. I think it's 58 slides.
Yeah. That's good. We got to do a dry run or something soon.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a dry run to see if it's feasible to get through it in an hour. How much time? I mean, some slides go quick, but then other ones might take a couple of minutes. It takes longer than you think to read shit. I mean, you know this.
My whole 3 days presentation was, I was just trying to constantly pare it down, and like, because all it was, and it felt like all it was in the end was reading.
That's what it's supposed to be, isn't it?
No, you're supposed to be able to talk to it and not just read something as a presentation, right? You should have notes, but then be able to just read to it. Like, you know, you don't want to present too much verbiage for the audience to just have to read along with, right?
Well, no, that's all you have, the present mode.
Yeah.
So that you can have your notes while they get slides. And then eventually it all just becomes intuitive. I mean, a lot of it is intuitive, but it's fucking a lot to pile in.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes. I haven't figured out how to do, because it was PowerPoint was telling me that there's a way to make my mouse like a laser pointer so that I can like move it around on my screen and highlight stuff on the slideshow, which would be handy for some stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of trying to, Claude just opened randomly on my computer.
Hi, Claude.
Oh, and asked me to update it. Yeah, hi, Claude. Creepy. Anyway, so yeah, that's going to be a time down in Ohio. It starts on the 19th, June 19th, the 23rd. this month. And of course, we got some Randall Carlson stuff coming up. Malta, Easter Island, it's all there. contact@thecabin.com. Dude, it must have been, I bet you it's 30 degrees outside right now.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. Is it hot there too?
About, I think it's about 26, 28, something like that.
It's supposed to rain a bunch.
Oh.
I think this weekend it looks like it's going to rain a whole bunch. So we'll see what happens. It is pretty dry out there. I'm getting sick of watering the lawn, which I'm probably not even doing enough of, but it's so, it seems like such a waste of time in Alberta. It's like, unless I'm going to water this thing for fucking 3 hours a night, and my yard's big, so it's like even the portion of it that's just grass to water it, I got the biggest sprinkler I could get, and I still got to move the thing like, you know, three times in the front to get all the little nooks and crannies, and then another takes like four spots in the back. So, I mean, this would be a full-time job. You need a sprinkler system. That would be the way to do it. So it just comes on 4 a.m. to like 4:30, gets the whole yard, shuts off before the sun comes out. Because I can't do it in the dark, Rad.
No, or you just need to give up your lawn. I mean, like, I'm sure if you were living in some areas, there'd be like restrictions on watering and stuff like that. So, you know, a lot of people can't even have lawns these days.
I think it's stage 4 water restriction right now or something. Actually, no, the sign's not there anymore, but it keeps going up and down. I don't know.
Just water a little bit of it. Just water like one patch and then just leave the sprinkler there and that's it. That's all you get, that green, and the rest can go brown.
I should just put in a sprinkler system.
Oh my God, dude. No, you don't even own the place.
It's only a couple $100. Then it's like you
want the green
like lawn? for a couple $100, and then you just never have to water the lawn again. You don't even have to fucking think about it. The lawn just waters itself. It's done. And dude, at my last place on the lake, I had the sump pump.
You had it connected to that?
Yeah. So it's just like a power thing. It was just like a powered outlet with a schedule on it that would just turn the power on, then the sump pump will kick on, and it would water the lawn. But now I don't have a lake, so.
Yeah, I don't worry about the lawn. I just water the flowers now, and we got some flowers planted, and just water those, and
just let the lawn dry out.
It's gonna dry out. Yeah, I mean it's beautiful right now. It's been raining quite a bit, in the last couple of weeks, so it's nice and green right now, but. I'm sure it'll dry out soon.
Do you get a lot of dandelions?
Yeah. In the back.
Yeah. They're fucking impossible.
Do you know how fast they grow in like 2 days? You cut them down and they grow in 2 days. Yeah, I know. It's unbelievable.
It's just like my weed whacker, I think, is like in the middle of my lawn right now where I just have given up.
But some people say just leave them, but Maria doesn't. She likes to get rid of them.
They're spreading. This is the problem with just leaving them. They're spreading. The whole lawn is just going to be dandelions soon if I let them keep doing what they're doing. I'm getting ready to just dope them. That's what it's going to come down to. Just go get some sort of chemical that fucks them up and not the...
not everything else.
And not everything else. Which is I've been trying to avoid, but there's... Because here's the thing. There's so much space here. The dandelions grow everywhere.
What? So what's the biggest...
There's like a half acre of lawn that I don't want the dandelions. For a while, I just let them go, but this is the problem.
Why do people not like them?
I don't even mind them. They're just killing the grass. So it's like if you go where all the dandelions are and you just give it a couple of years, there'll be no grass left. It'll just be those dandelion plants. So they just like take over the place.
Huh.
And I thought if I could just like cut them down quick enough so they couldn't go to seed, but it's almost my whole lawn now. Looks pretty. The bees like it, but got to do something. Got to do something about these dandelions. Poison them, I guess. Maybe somebody out there has some dandy advice on dealing with dandelions. Because I'm not having much luck over here. Really not having much luck over here. Ready to throw in the towel. I have successfully managed to keep the chickens in for like 3 weeks straight, though. Which is not bad, you know?
I don't understand.
Ah, dude, it's almost impossible to keep these chickens in the coop. Dude, you know what it's like? It's like they're little velociraptors. You can watch them. They just go like up and down, testing the fence.
Really? Up
and down, all day long. Really? All day long. And it's like eventually they'll like start just like poking their head in the same spot. So it's like I have to pin the chicken wire into the ground every couple of feet so that eventually they'll just shuffle underneath it otherwise. But then now what they're doing is they just like keep poking at the same hole and it gets a little bigger and it gets a little bigger and it just starts breaking and then they're squeezing through a hole the chicken shouldn't even fit through. But
and that,
there's one especially that and is just like fucking hell bent to just like all day long. That's
to
all
get
it
out.
Does.
Just trying to get out. And then what? And what's the problem with it getting out in the yard? It'll just get killed eventually.
I would let them in the yard if they would not just shit on the patio. They just, because for a while I was just letting them have the run of the yard and then trying to secure the patio because they just inevitably come and shit all over the patio. If I let them have the run of the place, it's like they, instead of going into their coop now, they'll go and they want to sleep on the patio and then they're shitting all over.
Is it retains heat or something or what? What
I don't know what the fuck it is, but they just like total it. And it's just a mess now. I got to clean it all up. It's a huge pain in the ass. So I just like gave up on doing that. And then I had a big long coop that almost went around the whole yard.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Underneath the fence, underneath the bushes.
Then it was too much. They just kept getting out. So I'm like, that's it. I'm cutting it down to like a third the size where I can really keep an eye on it and keep those chickens under wraps. And then I haven't ruled out maybe letting them out here and there for a little bit, but right now I'm just letting them really settle into this is it.
That's the problem. If you give them a taste of freedom, then maybe they want it all the time.
This is it. That's what to do. What have you been up to?
I built a workshop table. So that was
The bathroom's looking good.
Yeah, not bad, eh? Hung those lights from.
What? Are you bathing in there already?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I've been doing that for quite a while. Yeah.
And then you got a shower stall too, or just a bath?
Just a bath. I mean, you could, like, we have a thing where, you know, you could install a curtain in there or do something, but we don't need it right now. We're going to. But the problem is there's problems in the upstairs bathroom, so now I got to tear that whole thing apart and do that.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like. Wait till you have a month on your hands because that's going to be a can of worms.
I don't really have a functioning shower and the fucking things are all broken, the nozzles and stuff. So
bathrooms are always a can of worms.
Yeah.
It's like you start doing one thing.
I got to cut the bath out, rip that whole bath out, rip that whole area out, all the drywall, the bath, everything, and then just start from scratch in that corner.
I've done a few bathtub jobs.
Have you?
And everyone has been a fucking train wreck. You know, it's like, oh, this would be nothing. This would be quick. I remember when I bought the new toilet and put it in, I thought that would be quick. And even that was probably the quickest was the toilet, counterintuitively. It was actually like, as you saw, you put that wax seal down, plop it on, bolt her down, hook up the water, boom, you got a shitter. But the bathtub, I mean, dude, when I did that one in the basement of the other place when I first got divorced, I had to put, it was a whole like surround.
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna have to do.
And then I had to like build a little platform too to come up to
level it.
Well, I was in the basement, so I needed room to get that little P trap in there. I couldn't just do it on the concrete floor, so I had to build like a little fucking 6-inch platform that I was on, so I had room for that thing.
All right,
but it was a fucking nightmare. That was a nightmare too. It's a bathrooms are a nightmare. Seems like always.
I know. I don't know
how that one. I piped that one in and everything though, dude. I used all those snake bites. I wonder how long they hold up. If that place is like a ticking time bomb now.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just gotta do it at some point. But I'm gonna have to do the whole surround. Throw it because it's pretty tight in there too. So I'm gonna have to put a new bath in and then do the surround, but the window's in the way too. So I'm gonna have to cut the surround around the window. But I got to redo the window as well at some point. So do I wait? Did the windows first. The whole window, I was looking at the subsidies from the government because of all these energy things on. It's all gone. Not anymore. It ended last year. All the like Ooh. The rebates for putting in new windows and stuff.
Don't we get our food stamps pretty soon? Like 2 weeks?
Or UBI?
It's not, well, it's not, maybe it is the test UBI, but I think we're supposed to get that like one-time grocery top up.
Oh, that hasn't happened yet? Was that the $8 check I got from the government in the mail?
That was your food top up?
Is that my food top up? $8? Thanks.
That must be your tax return.
No, I don't. I owe them a massive amount of money, so it can't be that.
Maybe it was that then. That seems weird, though. Because I thought it was like June 5th. Oh, maybe that was your bread money. Did you get your, was that your bread lawsuit money?
I don't know. But I mean, I would have just told them not to give it to me. Because I'm like, you probably wasted $150 writing this $8 check for me. So thanks for nothing.
Probably wasn't cost. A new class action for like $33
trillion? I don't know.
For some bullshit. I got my second census. Follow what?
Up. They've been giving second ones around?
I just got my second one.
Yeah. So the people they don't hear from, they get. Who delivers that? The post office, or is there a separate?
It's got to be someone else, because if it was the post office, it would just go into my mailbox. I have a community mailbox.
Yeah, right.
Which I think the whole country is basically. I don't know any houses in Alberta that aren't on community mailboxes now. I think that's the norm throughout the country, except maybe parts of Ontario.
You mean province? You mean the country?
Yeah. Do you have a mail? Did you get mail to your house?
Nope. I have to go to a PO box. I have a centralized PO box.
Yeah, for like one per community, or in your little town, there's probably just one.
One post office,
and that's where your box is too.
And the box is there, yeah. And so we can't even get mail to our address. Like Amazon will deliver now to our address. It's weird, but sometimes it goes. Like I don't know who decides what comes to the house and what goes to the PO box, but mail doesn't come to the house. We have to go pick it up at the post office that has a PO box.
So
sometimes it's frustrating because they say, oh, this isn't like we don't deliver to PO box. It's like, well, I don't have an address for mail. Like it doesn't work. So.
Yeah, this is a problem.
Yeah.
That was the problem we had with the PO box.
Yeah.
It's like a bunch of stuff can't get shipped there. So surprise, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise. Well, support the show. America.ca/support. I unfortunately have no new supporters.
Oh boy.
Report this week.
We're
officially in a lull. We're in a downturn as we start the summer. Not looking good.
We know it's hard out there.
There's stuff out there. It is tough.
But if you can't afford it, then this is where we need all the rich people to just step up.
This is where we need the people who aren't poor to step up and support the show. GrandAmerica.ca/support. Otherwise we're going to have to go find something else to do. We'll get real jobs and podcast and do a real job again. It's too much. But you can prevent that. Head over to America.ca/support today. Sign up for monthly or make a one-time donation if you're getting a little value from the podcast. I mean, this is episode, 763? It must be 764. 764 episodes.
I'll check if you want. I'll check right now.
I'm pretty sure that's the right number. 764.
Yep.
Bingo bango with the monk. So be good if you guys signed up.
Well, I did get an email from Gary. His synchronicity that we talked about, I think it was last week or the week before, has compounded. So I can read that quickly.
The compound synchro?
Yeah.
Let's have it.
He says, you're not going to believe this shit. My wife and I were walking through a little shoreline village in CT. It must be Connecticut. And stopped at one of those free roadside library boxes where people swap books. I picked up one book that caught my eye, then quickly put it back and grabbed another one. My wife then grabbed the same book I had just put back, flipped to a page near the back and goes, holy shit, look at this. It had the exact same drawing of the Enzo circle that I have tattooed on my shoulder. The same meaning of moksha that got me here. And the only picture in the book. I mean, how does that happen? And if you read the first sentence after the circle in the picture, it gets even crazier, starting to wonder who or what is trying to tell me something. This synchro runs deep and can't wait to see what happens next. So he sent a picture and it says, and finally he understood its meaning.
Did he get the book?
No, no, he sent a picture of the symbol.
How do you not buy the book though?
Oh, no, no, it's just a free library. It's like one of those library exchange things.
Did he read the book?
No, probably not. I don't know. He probably brought the book home. Yeah, maybe that's how he continues it. You got to read that whole book.
You got to read the book. You get it. You got to read the book, report back.
Yeah, read the book and report back.
And see if there's any hawks in there or anything like that. That maybe we can get Graham Synchro going a little bit further with his buddy John 12 Hawks. Hawks. I haven't seen any hawks yet this year. Or eagles, just owls. And so many fucking gerbils, dude. Not gerbils.
Gerbils?
Not gerbils. You know, the little prairie dogs.
Oh, on the roads.
I've had like a couple breaches of my driveway now. They're just like, poof, come up right through the driveway. Now there's a hole in the driveway. So I've been like sticking tin cans down there and stuff and then filling the dirt back up with the hope that that'll be a weird stopping point for them or... I don't know what to do. I was thinking about pouring a bunch of diesel down there and lighting it on fire. And like, the thing is, it's probably connected to something else, but if you could just suck all the oxygen out of the system, I'd fucking get them.
Jeez. Maybe you should watch Caddyshack again and see how they took care of all the gophers.
Those are different, weren't they? Was it
probably pretty same thing. They have a gopher hold going down in the course, right? Who was it? Not John Candy, but the other really funny
Dan Aykroyd?
No, it wasn't him either. It wasn't Chevy Chase either. It was the other guy. Why can't I think of his name? And he was his job was the greenskeeper of the course.
I do remember that. Bill Murray?
Bill Murray, yeah. If I kill all the gophers, who's gonna play on the course? And he was after the gophers and he put dynamite down in the hole and
Did it work? Did the dynamite work? I think he used to be able to buy arsenic and all that stuff. But the problem with that is it's like...
You hate to kill things, you know, that's the thing.
Especially with poison. Seems like that could backfire. That being said, I think they've been like airdropping arsenic at the Saskatchewan-Alberta border for like 100 years. So keep out your rats.
When I used to drive back and forth from here to there all the time, those prairie dogs would pop up on the side of the road and they'd run across and there'd be like dead ones all over because you'd catch them, you know, running under your tires and
little splatter patches.
Yeah.
Have you seen any rats since you got to Saskatchewan?
No.
Did you see any in BC?
You know, I'm reading this book on Easter Island and that was their main... They said this is written in 1919, but they said that the main their food source was rats back then.
I think they're talking about guinea pigs, though.
Are they? Yeah, it must be, right? I don't remember rats being a thing.
Which is technically a rat, but I think it's
maybe it's a rodent.
It's a little less scavengery.
Yeah.
Probably still not great, but I think they eat
When they get cows and pigs and stuff on there, I wonder.
Timmy was eating guinea pig in Peru. I don't know if he ate any, but it was like on the menu.
But it must have been in the last 100 years where they got, less than that even, where they got cows and stuff on Easter Island?
Oh, no, I'd imagine they've had cows the whole time. I think people were like rolling around with cows on their boats and shit, weren't they? Probably had cows and chickens.
But they weren't eating
stuff. Well, you'd eat them if the ship went down for sure. But I think the goal would probably, like, wouldn't those ships have a hold in the bottom with some livestock down there?
Yeah, but I'm talking about on the island itself.
Yeah, and then you get to the island and you move in.
Yeah, but they're saying that they only ate the rodents.
Oh, for a long time, I'm sure, but not 100 years. I'd say like ever since we had like decent sized boats going there, you know? Yeah. Seems like when they were ripping around on canoes and catamarans, they were mostly eating rats. Rats and tuna. There was no guinea pig on the menu, though. So, for what it's worth, I would try it. I wouldn't eat the head like Timmy did, but I would try the... I mean, it looks kind of succulent, kind of like a rabbit, you know? A rabbit's pretty tasty, tender meat. Wonder if they got more fat on them.
Well, yeah, because if you heard that, there's a name for it where people would die from eating too much rabbit and not enough fat. Like, there's... Your body can't process that much protein without the fat?
Yeah, it's some sort of starvation, but I think you pretty well get that with anything, honestly, because you could watch, I watched that Alone show, and the one year that dude shot a fucking muskox, man, but then the Wolverine stole his bag of, like, fat from the muskox.
What?
Because he had all that separate and the fat got taken. So dude's eating like fucking steaks.
What's a muskox? It's like an ox?
It's like a cross between like a bison and a moose.
Okay.
Huge. And the meat was just so lean, he was still wasting away. So he's eating steaks every day and wasting away.
Wow. That's what it's... It might be the wasting. It might be something about wasting. I can't remember.
You need some fat. You need some fat in the system to get that shit going. That's why you'd eat probably all the parts of the animal back in the day, because that's what fat was. And we found pigs, and we were like, fuck yeah. But honestly, it's probably more bears than anything that we were... Bears and fish is probably where we're getting most of our fat from. You know, ducks got a lot of fat on them, too. I keep saying I'm going to start doing the duck fat, but I never have. Because I think it's as easy as just throwing them carcasses in a giant boiling pot, boiling the shit out of them.
And then
letting it cool, and then it'll get that solidify on top.
Layer, and then just peel it off.
Take that off and boil it down.
That's a good idea, yeah. Then you can bring a cauldron with you or something. That's the problem.
Well, I wouldn't bring it with me. I clean the ducks at home usually.
Yeah.
You just need to get it. I mean, that duck fat is expensive, man. It was like, when I bought it before, it was like $8 for a little tiny jar of it. Maybe I should be selling duck fat, American duck fat.
There you go.
The thing is, food products are, you gotta like, they want to come check out your kitchen and all this crazy stuff.
It can't even expand through provinces. I mean, that's one of the provincial restrictions that's super frustrating, is if you're approved in BC, that doesn't mean you can ship it across to the other provinces. It's bullshit. That's one thing they should streamline.
You'd think they would streamline something.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, we do need people to support the show. It's important. I know you forget about it sometimes, but time to step up. If you are in a position, maybe you can double up your subscription to make way for the people that have fallen off due to financial concerns, which is a couple emails a week at this point to people that got to quit supporting because of the economy. It's not better up here. So tell your friends about the show and support the show. GrimAmerica.ca/support. Of course, check out that event at contact@thecabin.com. Do you have a bio for Monk Yaw Rom?
I do, yeah.
Did I get it right that time?
No, it's Yun Ro.
This is why you got to put it in the top of the thing for me.
I can just spell it instead of real spelling, the phonetic spelling. You know?
I'm like the anchor man. I'm like Ron Burgundy. I'll just read whatever's on the teleprompter.
He's been called the Zen Gabriel Garcia Marquez for his works of magical realism. Born Arthur Rosenfeld in New York, he received his academic background at Yale, Cornell, the U of C. Officially ordained a Taoist monk in Guangzhou, People's Republic of China. His award-winning nonfiction works on Taoism bridge science, spirituality, and philosophy, while his novels have been optioned for film in both Hollywood and Asia. He lives in the American Southwest with his wife, international teacher of Tai Chi and Taoism, and travels frequently in the Far East. Monk Yun Ru, so Monk, Yunrou.com. And there's a link in the show notes there to that. And also there's a
Absolutely. This could take the title for like worst fucking up of a guest a guest name in the history of the show.
It's a good thing he's a monk and he's got lots of compassion and he won't like, you know, hold any resentments. Sorry, monk.
Sorry, monk. All right. Well, there you have it, guys. Please do support the show. Have a great week and enjoy the chat with Monk Yun Ro. Hey, I got it.
Monk Yun Ro, welcome to Grimerica. Thanks for joining us. I think that name is translated as soft cloud, right?
Thank you for pronouncing it so spectacularly well.
Thank you for the pronunciation. So this will be fun. We're going to talk about your new book, which is Interstellar, the Revelation, a novel of interstellar contact. But we're also going to talk about all kinds of awesome stuff. How you doing today?
I'm doing. Still here.
We thought it would be fun to chat with a monk about interstellar contact because it's almost like an oxymoron in a way, you'd think. But with everything going on in the world and all this interest in UAPs, I thought this will be a fun chat because, we like sci-fi books and fiction based on fact and all this stuff. And with everything that's happening in the world, it must be interesting timing for you to come out with a book about interstellar contact when everybody's talking about UFOs.
Yeah, so I'll tell you the background on the book in a minute, but I want to address something else, which is the coincidence of what's going on right now in the world and Taoism and the philosophy of religion in which I'm a monk. So there's been a lot of talk. I listened to some congressmen recently talk about how the government is very reluctant to share and very cautious because they are afraid that what's going to be revealed will create what this particular congressman termed ontological shock. Right. And what that means in plain terms is having our world so shaken in terms of who we think we are and what we think we know that, you know, everything turns topsy-turvy and what the social and cultural and economic consequences of that and military even might be. And I get that, but I'm fascinated by this idea of ontological shock by being, you know, sticking your tongue in the electric socket and finding out that everything that you thought you knew about everything is wrong, including what is time and what is space. But the intersection, and, you know, you mentioned funny to have a monk talk about this stuff. The intersection for me is that Taoism, which is a very old, very, very ancient philosophy, before it became a religion of any kind, it was used as divination and talking about thousands of years ago in proto-China and Neolithic riverine cultures and all that. And an idea in Taoism is that in some kind of loose parallel to our book of Genesis, the way we think of creation or the origin of things in the West, and also evolution, by the way. The Taoists have this idea that there is a property inherent in the universe, which causes it to interact a certain way with us and us with it, and also a cosmogony, an origin story, a creation story, if you like, but without a creator. So I had I don't want to call it an argument. Let's say I had a heated discussion with a Franciscan monk in New Mexico a couple of years back when I visited this place. And he said, how can you talk about the beginning of the world without talking about God? And I said, how can you talk about God without asking who made him? And he said, well, we don't like that question. I said, aha. So we got into this idea that ontological shock happened in the West during the 60s when the hippie generation, people started to, never mind psilocybin and other hallucinogens, but just started to wonder whether the Abrahamic version is the way. And they looked east to Buddhism and Taoism, and they came up with this whole different way of looking at the world. That was an ontological shock. Was it as upsetting as knowing that little green men are pulling our strings and our ear hairs? I don't know. But it was one. And I find any time when we really have to shake up what we think we know to be interesting.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because what I was going to ask you is this shock only really happening in the West, or does it only need to happen in the West? Because I feel like, you know, we were in Chile recently, and the Chilean government and seems to have accepted this phenomena for a long time, a couple decades probably, and the people just accept it. They talk about it openly. And all kinds of parts in the East, sort of this, you know, this spiritual, metaphysical dimension and the UAP kind of UFO phenomena seems to be accepted. It's just in the West that we're going to be shocked. No?
So I think this is a very interesting point, which I have to say, I've done quite a lot of interviews around this book and nobody has asked me that. So I salute you, sir. That was a good one. I think, first of all, you know, when you read about the Artemis astronauts looking back at the little blue marble and having this, their own version of ontological shock, seeing how we are just this little dot floating in space, and who cares what color our skin is, what our features look like, where on the planet we live, what we think we know, what we believe. We're all just, you know, clinging to this little rock, and we have much more in common with each other than we do with all the other things that the Artemis crew may or may not have seen as well, and that NASA has lots to say about, but we're only beginning to hear about it now. So it is, the ontological shock we're talking about is indeed a global phenomenon, and thank you for making that point. You know, I live in Arizona. So, you know, of course, I'm American and I see what's going on with our government. But I read a couple of days ago that there's a guy in Japan who is known as the UFO summoner. And like we have one here, too, who meditates and calls the orbs. And this is pretty well documented. They come to him. So there's one of those in Japan. You know, there may well be those in other countries, too. I don't think Bill Maher said something really funny a few nights ago or weeks ago, I guess now. He said that if you don't believe in extraterrestrials or interdimensionals, if you don't believe that the government has got a lot of stuff going on that it's not telling us, if you don't believe those things, you are the conspiracy theorist.
Yeah. How far we've come.
How far we've come. Yeah. So, let me use that, if I might, as a jump-off point, because I wrote this book in 1990.
Oh, wow. What?
Yeah. That's when I told you there was a backstory.
Well, yeah, but I thought it was because you made it about 1992. So, I didn't know you.
So, I wrote the book. I was working as a screenwriter and adapting my own novels and so on to the screen in Hollywood with some success. back then, and I was working with some big names. I'm too bold to say who they were, but I was working with some big guys on these things. And somebody in that industry said to me, have you ever thought of doing sci-fi? And I said, I don't know, I loved sci-fi when I was a kid, you know, but Asimov and Bradbury and all those, Bester. But I kind of got taken over by the fantastical and mystical, and I became a Tolkien freak. And so I kind of went away from sci-fi, and I've never written any. Anyway, this Hollywood personality said to me, I think you'd be good at it. He planted a seed in my mind, you know, 36 years ago. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, you know, the thing that I've always wanted to see, a UFO, I've always wanted a visitor, I've always believed that it's preposterous, hubristic, and ridiculous to think that we are alone. Ridiculous. So I embarked on a 2-year quest to go to all these tinfoil hat meetings in Vegas. I read John Mack and Whitley Strieber and all these people who were writing about abductees, and some, both Strieber believed he himself had been abducted. I read all kinds of stuff, Jacques Vallée, and then I went to these meetings, and what I came away with going to these meetings, and I'm going again to Contact in the Desert shortly, which is the first meeting that I will have gone to since the days I wrote the book. What I came away with was that the people I talked to there were, I was not in a position to say they were crazy. And I was also not in a position to say what, if anything, happened to them. But I came away believing that they believed that something had happened. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know what to say about trauma and how it may manifest. And it's not my business, not my field. But I was very moved by a lot of people I met. And I began to think, you know, maybe I've been treating this all as craziness, but maybe it isn't. Then I went to visit the Hopi on First Mesa. I drove my motorcycle from LA out to First Mesa, and I went up to look at the rock paintings that were, you know, 1,100, 1,200 years old, carbon dated, showing little spaceships with guys coming out of them wearing helmets and stuff. And of course, that they're not the only ones. Anyway, I just went deeper and deeper and deeper into the subject 36 years ago. At that time, I came up with this idea. And the idea was that I called the book, at that time I gave it a working title of Truck Stop Earth. I wrote the book on the presumption that they're here all the time. There are all kinds of them. We don't, you know, they're in our drain pipes and they're on top of the mountains, and we don't know what they look like. We don't know, but they're here. And that they haven't announced themselves to us because we're manic murder monkeys. And they don't want us spreading our stuff around the galaxy. And that they are waiting for us to evolve into something else. So if you can stay with me a minute on this subject.
Yeah.
I had a, many, many years after this, I had a conversation in the early aughts with my Taoist master, a Chinese guy. And we were driving in Florida, and he looked at on I-95 at all the sprawl, and he said, it's too late for people. Humanity is over. And I said, well, I hope you're wrong about that. And he said, I just want to retire to a mountaintop in China. I want to make a bunch of money, and I want to go there, and I want to be insulated from the world, and I want to have somebody fielding my call so that if you call, you know, I was going by Arthur then. I said, if you call and she tells me Arthur's on the phone, I'll say, Arthur who?
Was that him or you that was?
No, it was him.
Okay.
So I didn't want to tell him that was a little hurtful, you know. And I said, but you know, I have hope that humankind will step up. And I think the only way it can happen is if we evolve. And if we suddenly start, because evolution is full of, the famous biologist Stephen Jay Gould talked about saltatory, jumping, leaping, evolutionary leaps in the fossil record. You know, you don't find
Cambrian explosion.
That's right. You don't find like a little tiny thumb and then a bigger one. You find no thumb and then you find a thumb. And, you know, the forward, the bipedal gait and all this stuff that determines how we see the world and how we interact with it. So I said to my teacher in the early aughts, I said, you know, I'm hoping that we are able to have an evolutionary leap. Now, what I didn't tell him is that I had written about that, you know, 25 years earlier. So in the book that I wrote in 1990, I conflated a leap in who we are, little what I call indigo children suddenly appearing all over the world, able to do amazing things and see things differently, and the arrival of the aliens who have been waiting for this. Anyway, so that's the story in the Revelation. So now we're back in 1990. I finished this book, feeling pretty good about it. I'm going to, you know, give it to Hollywood people and see if we can't make a movie out of it. And I go to work on it one morning. I turn on my laptop, little Toshiba laptop, and I get a screen, dark.
No way.
The screen says, bad disc. 136,000 words. 600-page book. No iCloud, no backups, no Dropbox. And I had a little ancillary drive, but that was fried also. I don't know what happened. You know, something during the night. Power surge.
Wow.
Gone.
Wow.
Gone with the wind, the whole book. To say that I was upset at the loss of this work is not to really convey. It's, you know, it felt like losing a child. It's a terrible thing to say. I have a child. It's not really like that, but it was bad. And I was so traumatized by it that in the years that came after, I took the computer all over LA begging people, please. And some smart ass in a computer store said to me, you got any friends at the FBI? Maybe they can get it back for you. We can't. Nobody here is going to help you. So it was gone. 2 years spec work, not a penny for it. In the time after, every once in a while, somebody would say, hey, you ever think about writing sci-fi? And I would reply, say that to me again, and those will be the last words we ever speak.
Tai Chi your ass.
Tai Chi your ass. So when my son was growing up, I used to tell him bedtime stories based on the book. Came to Earth in a bubble. I told him he was half an alien because I married an Earth woman. And he told him he had special powers. And he always wanted, Daddy, I want to read that book, you know, when he got older. And I like, I want to give you that book. But yeah, anyway, October of 24, my mother passed away in New York. I joined my siblings there to go through her stuff. We're cleaning out the house. We come across a cardboard box sitting in the bottom of a closet on the floor. And in the cardboard box are 600 manuscript pages printed.
No way.
With a note on top that says, Mom.
No.
I don't trust computers.
No.
Please put this away for safekeeping somewhere.
No way.
And, you know, I had some like cognitive dissonance looking at this because, among other things, I have no memory to this day.
Oh, my God. I'm doing
it. I have no memory of sending it to her, which for the conspiracy minded brings up all kinds of stuff, like how did that get there and what, you know.
Yeah.
But the fact is that if the book had come out at that time, the whole relevance of it and how it was perceived would have been completely different. It would have been one more lunatic fringe piece of sci-fi and not something of the moment like it is now. So, of course, when I retrieved it, you know, I looked at it. I was desperately afraid it would be terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because I thought, oh, geez, a young writer, what did I know back then? And what if it's bad? And it as I was reading it on the airplane, you know, TSA tried to take it away from me and put it through the conveyor belt. I wouldn't let them. I said, you have to scan me. I'm not letting go of this. They said, sir, you got, I said, eh, you take it away from me, I'm not going on the plane. I said, I'm not letting go of this. You don't understand what it is. Anyway, you know, I read it on the plane. I thought, wow, I've forgotten a lot about how much fun the story was. And so I spent, you know, in March of 25, which was just a few months later, I had some brain surgery for this disease in my brain. And they put in this shunt, this beautiful thing here. And it goes down the tubes and goes down my neck and down the front of my body and empties into my gut. So the water from my brain doesn't build up, which it was doing and making me crazy. And in my convalescence, oh, well, after that surgery, I arrested in the recovery room and passed away. And they did CPR for 4 or 5 minutes. My family was there. And it didn't work. They took out the paddles and they shocked me once, twice, three, four times. And after four times, the doctor in the hospital looked at my family and said, I'm sorry, he's gone. And my son, who's a biologist, went crazy. Do it again, do it again. And they shocked me 2 more times, and here we are.
Wow, wow.
So in the convalescence from that, I brought the book up to, you know, modern standard and modern time. I was lying in bed, you know, I was tapping away on my laptop. Anyway, that's the backstory of the book.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. It's so interesting, though, that the talking about Indigo Children, that must be the very beginning. I mean, that must have been at the very start of when that, I mean, from what I remember, you know, that whole Indigo Child thing was from the, I don't know, maybe the late 90s, the aughts. You were ahead of the game on that in a way.
I was ahead of the game in conflating our evolution with the interest of the aliens. And when I had that conversation in the aughts with my master, you know, and I said, I think we need to evolve. He said, I just want to leave. I just want to go to like the etheric plane. I don't want anything to do with people anymore. I don't want to go to that mountain and, you know, not have anything to do with anybody. I said, well, you know, I don't know. I'd like to help people. He said, well, from a Buddhist point of view, I'm an arhat and you are a bodhisattva. You want to come back for the benefit of all sentient beings. I said, I don't know, this is getting pretty fancy to me, but I'm hoping we can evolve past this. And I didn't tell him about the book back then, you know. It was long gone.
Well, I have a few questions. I guess just staying on that topic before I ask you some more deeper questions, but has your view of that evolutionary expectation from NHI changed at all? Because, you know, I've kind of gone back and forth on that myself, thinking that there's mainly good NHIs out there, then there's both. Now they're kind of, you know, pushing out there that there's some bad ones out there, and that, you know, are we rare in our ability to create conflict out of nothing, or is this inherent throughout the universe? Like, has any of that changed for you at all?
These are really good questions.
Well, especially in regard to what's happening in our modern times.
I mean that in a complimentary way.
No, thanks.
So as a philosophy, Taoism has some very specific things to say about conflict. And, you know, you mentioned the martial art of Tai Chi, which I've been practicing forever. I got a lot of students around the world. And I specialize in Tai Chi was a battlefield art. Mostly we associate it with old people and the birds in the park communing with nature and trying not to suffer from arthritis or high blood pressure or whatever. But actually, it was about a different kind of survival originally. So we're talking about thousands of years if you include all of its progenitors and various incarnations. But in the way we practice it in some places today, the original art, Chen style, that originated in the early 1600s. And at that time, you know, China had no infrastructure, not like what it is today. So, you know, I'd been living in a little village, and one morning you'd wake up to the thundering of hooves and the emperor's conscriptors would come into your village, and every male between 15 and 50 would be yanked off to war. And they would be yanked off to go fight against somebody they never heard of, for a guy they never met, for a reason they didn't care about or even understand. And in this one particular family, they had their own private indigenous martial art, which was based on Taoism and Chinese medicine and the folk martial arts of the day. And that system really worked. And what does it mean it really worked? Well, it means that, you know, their fathers and sons and uncles and brothers and cousins were swept off by the soldiers, but they came home. Nobody else came home. Everybody was slaughtered on the battlefield. And so the people from this village got a good reputation. And, you know, eventually the emperor hired them for, rich people took them for bodyguards and caravans and so on. They did protection work and they taught in Beijing. But the idea of conflict, and one of the reasons, and this connects, I hope, to your question, one of the things about that martial art that is different from every other martial art, and it's not to say it's better or worse or anything, it's just different. In every martial art, there's a conversation. So, you know, you stumble out of the club into the alley late at night and some dude comes up to you and, Graham, wallet. Okay, stuff happens. He gives you this, you give him that. And all kinds of martial arts studios around the world, they train it. You get this, I get this, you know, and we go back and forth, and it's a dialogue until somebody wins. Somebody's faster, stronger, their technique is better. Tai Chi is not that way. So I'm asking for a little mental stretch here to connect this to seeing how aliens may view things. And how they may think about our combative nature. In Tai Chi, we don't have any interest in hurting the other person, nor do we care if we do. So in that sense, it's, you know, could be seen as being cruel. All we are interested in is, I am in my happy place, and you are taking me out of it. With your kick, your punch, your attack. What I'm going to do is return to my happy place. There's a word for it. My equilibrium, my emotional balance. If in the course of me returning to myself and my own equilibrium and my happy place, you happen to fly off the cliff and you know, get scraped up by a bunch of thorns on the way down and land up on the rocks. And didn't go well for you. Sorry, I guess you shouldn't have attacked me all I was doing was returning to my happy place. And unfortunately for you, that happened. I don't know that I would venture to guess what an advanced intelligence might think about conflict. I don't know that we could understand that any more than an ant could understand us. I really don't know. But I can say that there are more than one way, even for human beings. There is more than one way for human beings to look at conflict. And that maybe part of our evolution is cultural, not just that we grow a bigger brain or stronger muscles or we're faster or better swimmers or whatever else. Not even that we have higher IQs, but something more fundamental about who we think we are. And we see the interconnectedness of all things. And we understand that even the fly that you just carelessly whack because he's buzzing around and bothering you, you know, all these living creatures are connected. So I was on that subject. I was given a class a few months ago, and it was a Zoom class. So I had some people from around the world join me. We have a Wednesday night class. And all of a sudden, this house fly lands on my screen, like I'm talking to you guys now. But, you know, just he lands on the screen. And so I'm busy shooing him off the screen, and he goes to my keyboard. And obviously, you know, I don't want to whack him on my keyboard. I don't want to whack him on my screen either. But I want to whack him on the keyboard because I'm afraid I'll disconnect the call, you know. So I put my fingers down to type something, and the little fly climbs up on my finger. And then it goes to the back of my hand while I'm typing in the chat room, you know. I think, okay, it's not bothering me really. He stays there for the whole class. He just hangs out, this little house fly. And everybody's laughing. You know, they could see him on this camera. I go, look, this little guy's living on the back of my hand. He doesn't want to leave. And I go, okay, fly away. And I shake my hand. He won't go. Later, when the class is over, I take him outside and I put him on a flower. He won't go. I say, listen, you have no future living on the back of my hand, my friend. Here, look, you're outside now. Be free. Flowers, plants, food, go. Be free. Fly, little fella. He doesn't go. He flies and he lands on my forehead and he won't leave. And I spend most of the day hanging with this little dude. And the whole time that I'm thinking, it's a fly. I could talk to you. I have a house full of animals. You know, I'm a nature-oriented guy. I got all kinds of turtles in the... But... a fly. And as the longer he hangs, the more I think, you know, we're part of the same thing. He's trying to make a living, I'm trying to make a living, everybody's trying to make a living, whatever that means to them. And in hurting him, I hurt the thing of which I myself am made. So when we talk about evolution and you ask me what I think might be in the minds of ET, what I hope is that there is some sense of that interconnectedness and where that might lead.
Yeah, I agree. It's just, for me, it seems like it's too, we're too, like he said about the highway, what he was driving on the highway, like we're, it's too late. Like it's too late for us to take that evolutionary leap to belong to this galactic civilization. Like we're past the point where we can evolve to that. And that's kind of, or not only that that it's not going to happen fast enough. Like we're going to destroy ourselves before we can become part of that civilization. Which I mean, maybe it's part of the challenge that we go through every 10 or 12,000 years with a cyclical cataclysm that we kind of get to this point where we reach out and. We may not quite make it before we get reset back to the Stone Age, literally, again.
I was reading a book called Apocalypse, which came out recently by a very good science writer. I recommend it. It's a nice book. Maybe calling it a nice book is not the best way to describe it, but it's an interesting book. And if you listen to Ray Kurzweil at the Media Lab, formerly now at Google, I think it's Google, a big proponent of AI, his claim is that our only purpose, that is, all organic life on Earth, culminating in the pinnacle that he sees us to be. I happen not to agree with that, but that's a separate point. Our purpose is just to facilitate the birth of general artificial intelligence or super AI. And that once that exists, the persistence of organic life is irrelevant. So I'm writing a follow-up to the revelation now, okay, in which I, another book in which I focus on the AI question, but that's not so much in the revelation. The revelation is more about evolution, not about AI.
What did you have to update? Like you said, you had to rewrite it to get it up to modern times. What sort of predictions were you spot on, and what sort of stuff needed updating?
So at some point, you know, during the editing, I reached a fork. And Darren, it's a good question. Also, I reached a fork, which is, do I basically throw away this whole book and write like a modern version of it, which takes place in the time of texting and the web and, you know, things that weren't really ubiquitous back then? Or do I use some literary device to maintain the story as it is? And I opted for the latter because I felt like there was value in the story as it was and that I shouldn't throw it away. So I did. I created this device. I added a preface. And the preface was written by the son of the protagonist. And it was talking, this is my father's story. And now everybody knows his name because he was the one who facilitated, you know, first contact. And he's his household name. But what you don't know is, you know, this story I'm going to tell it to you. And that the son, you know, is a member representing Earth of the Galactic Federation. But the father, you know, has a different story. So that was one change I made. And then, you know, there were just like little niggling things about stuff like people posting things in newspapers instead of online. And, you know, I updated it somewhat. But again, I didn't want to change it from the 90s. So I didn't like totally rewrite it. I just made it so that it would make sense to a reader now. But I do state that, you know, what's going on is something that happened in the 90s.
You were talking about, you've crossed over twice in the last 5 years, and you were talking about recently realizing that there may have been a message in there somewhere. Can you expand on that a bit?
This fungal disease in my brain is a relatively common thing in the Southwest. It's in California also. You breathe in the spores, and then it begins in your lungs. And some small number of people, it disseminates into their body, and different organs can go to the skin, the heart, the liver, and on, go anywhere. Only a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the fairly large number of people who get this disease end up with it in the brain. You know, I won that lottery. And, you know, that's a really bad diagnosis. You know, when I first got it, I was told, you know, very short time, get your affairs in order and all that. And when I asked for a life expectancy, you know, they wouldn't answer that. Wow. Like, well, you know, you're a monk, you do we don't know, we're going to try in the new drug, blah, blah, blah. You know, to avoid, understandably, you know, saying you got 12 weeks, you know. So at one point, the disease resulted in kidney failure for me, and I passed away in sepsis, got an infection. And my wife called the paramedics, and they came, and I don't really remember any of that. I guess I fell in the shower or something. But I remember waking up as I'm wheeled in to the emergency room, and I see a doctor there. He's got thick glasses, and he's wearing a mask, and it's COVID time, and you know, it's 21. And I look up at him, and I say, you know, how am I doing? And he says, not good. He said, you went to the other side. We had to bring you back. I said, yeah, I figured. He said, I'm going to give you 50-50. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I've been about 50-50 about this myself. There's been so much suffering and misery with this disease. I think I'm kind of 50-50 whether I stay or whether I go. And he said, well, I'm going to do my best. I said, good, do your best. But if it doesn't work, I don't want to be the patient that, you know, you wake up on the weekend going, damn, I couldn't save that guy. Because just know I'm okay either way, really. And he looks at me and says, I've been doing this 30 whatever years and never had a patient say that to me. And I said, yeah, well, maybe never had a monk. I don't know. He says, a monk? I said, yeah, it's a long story. So after that, I went into a coma, and I was in a coma for the better part of a week. And during the time I was in a coma, this is 21, I had what I have no real better option than to call it a vision. You know, there are visions in Taoist tradition, so I use that word. But I don't know really what I mean by that. What I can tell you is that I was in the presence of something else, someone else that was with me. And I would love to tell you it was Moses or Jesus or Buddha or Lao Tzu. But I never really got a sense of who it was. But I refer to this entity as the curator. And the reason I call him the curator is that it was like I was a big donor to some museum. And I went in and asked for a tour. And because I gave a lot of money or I gave a lot of artwork or whatever, they gave me a special tour, like behind the scenes, seeing things that they thought I would be interested in seeing. So I found myself zooming through galaxies like a comet. I was up there in space. This is why I make the ET comment. And it didn't occur to me, you know, for years that it might have had anything to do with that. Only recently did I go, well, I wonder, which sounds kind of strange, but I don't know. I didn't remember that I sent my mother the manuscript either, so maybe I'm just defective that way. And all over the galaxy, I am shown planets teeming with life. I don't like land on them or meet ET or anything, but I just am zooming by and there's life, 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 all over. And at the end of that coma journey, that vision, I'm shown the future of the human race. and what is going to happen to us. I did, you know, at that time, I did a lot of interviews about that because everybody wanted to know. But now I think in the current context that maybe seeing the first part of the vision and seeing the universe teeming with life was actually the more interesting thing. You know, people being people, they want to know what's going to happen to us. I don't care about that. You're more likely to find people learning how to put on their eyeliner on TikTok than people trying to find out what's really going on with the government and UFOs. That's the world we live in. Anyway, when I was shown what was happening, what was going to happen to us, I didn't like it. I didn't like what I was being shown. And I objected. No, 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 no. No, no, no. And I got agitated, you know, inside the vision. And as a consequence of that agitation, I woke up.
Wow.
And when I woke up, the first thing I wanted was to hear Amazing Grace. Because I had a sense of my own insignificance. And the wretch business really stuck with me. And my wife was with me, and she called a recording artist who's a friend of ours and asked her if she would sing Amazing Grace for me. I just needed to hear about the wretch, you know. And I think I can connect the wretch to all this as follows. I would like to tell you, in the same way that I would like to tell you that it was one of our gods or deities that came and took me zooming through the galaxy, but I can't. That's not the case that I'm aware of. I would also like to tell you that I'm the kind of monk, the macho monk, maybe not so much soft cloud, but maybe dragon fist or iron leg or something, where if some entity came to me and said, hey, you've been practicing for 45 years and, you know, you're very close to the top of the mountain now and you could see a lot. But, you know, to totally pop your cork and be able to see everything, you got like 8 more steps to go. You need to go to 1,008 steps. You're only at 1,000. But those 8 steps, and this would be referring to the misery in the hospital and the coma and the dying and all that pain, and those 8 steps are going to be more grotesque and more torturous than your little pitiable brain can imagine. I would like to tell you that I'm the kind of monk who would say, bring it on, baby. I want to get to the top. I want to wake up. I want to see everything. Actually, I'm the wretch who would say, yeah, you know, 1,000 steps is good. I'm good where I am. I'll practice another 25 years. Maybe I'll get there, maybe not. But, you know, I don't need this, all this trauma and misery. Yeah, so that's when I woke up, I was thinking, I'm not the macho monk I wish I was. So what I saw happening to the human race.
Yeah, I got to ask the question.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. You know, I'd like to tell you that I have a complete understanding of what happens to all organic life on Earth, not just to people. And maybe if I hadn't had such a strong negative reaction to what I was shown, I might have stayed in the vision longer instead of getting sort of a tough love from my curator who said to me, hey, dude, sorry you don't like it. It's the way it is, you know. And by the way, before I tell you what he showed me, I have zero doubt in my mind that what he showed me is going to come to pass. I call it he. It could have been a she. I don't know. It. What the curator showed me. I am as sure of that experience as I am that I am sitting in my office at Soft Cloud Temple in Tucson talking to you guys on the computer. I mean, it was as real. There wasn't a dreamlike quality. I didn't have like you know, the kinds of things that you feel in dreams. I was just looking at it. So what I saw was a vessel floating in space. I mean a spaceship, a vessel. And the ship was an organic sort of incongruous, not very symmetrical thing. It reminded me of kind of an Alaskan king crab claw, like a long leg with bumps, and the surface was made of something like carbon fiber, but it wasn't that. But I remember touching it and my hand kind of went into the surface, like maybe little meteorites and things could hit it without breaking it. And inside that thing, which was miles and miles long, an enormous craft, inside of it was not a collective consciousness, but instead were all the individual consciousnesses of humans on planet Earth. So billions of them preserved inside that thing. Now, you know, I want to tell you that the whales were there also, and the roaches, and the marsupials, and the lemurs, and the birds. And I can't say they were or they weren't. I didn't really get to see that part. But I got to see that this is, that clearly we are going to become non-corporeal beings, and whether we are silicon or something else, our future is going to be in that craft, and we will all be preserved there. And I had a very negative reaction to this. But in the weeks that followed the vision, I began to think that maybe I should not have judged what I was shown so harshly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, without bodies, okay, you know, we didn't have a great meal and great sex and all the rest of it. But we also didn't have any suffering. And we also didn't have mortality. And maybe I was being shown a higher, better outcome for us than what I fear or what other people have suggested. And maybe this dovetails with Kurzweil's vision somehow of us becoming some other kind of thing than we are, you know, androids or digital versions of ourselves. I'm not in a position to say, but all I can say is that there's a part of me that wished that I hadn't had such a knee-jerk reaction, because maybe if I had not, I would have been shown more.
Yeah, you might have had more of the answer. Because what came to me was arc, and then I thought, well, maybe it's an astral arc. You know, maybe that's the way we all travel to the next thing or something. But
a spaceship.
Yeah, there's some stuff going on around quantum and quantum mechanics and multi dimensions, which says that, you know, when we die, you know, it's not the end for us, because we're simultaneously existing in all these different dimensions. And, you know, when one of them blinks out, we just go on to another one.
Yeah.
Not quite the same as reincarnation, really, but you could think of it as related.
Yeah. Yeah. That resonance holds our something of ours together, some sort of quantum entangled sort of consciousness together. Yeah, that's fascinating. Darren, did you have a question? Or
well, is that kind of what the premise of the book is, or is that different?
So the book takes us from arrival, from the book is, the book has as its main character you two guys. The book has a 1990s talk show host who's wildly popular. There were podcasts back then, you know. And he comes across a story of one of these indigo children. And his show is based in L.A., and he flies to Connecticut to meet this kid and her mother and do a story on them. And when he's flying back to LA, I don't want to give away too much of the story. Here's the revelation. Something happens on that flight. Something happens to the airplane involving an alien, more than one. And he is chosen, along with some other people in other countries who have a similar media presence, to be the one who breaks it to the world. Dudes and dudettes, we ain't alone. Guess what? They're coming. And so, you know, his story of how he does that and how that happens and how he gains credibility and, you know, gets people to listen to him and that he's real. He, a human, is real and really is talking to E.T. and all that. That's the story.
So do you see any parallels with what's happening? Or not parallels, but can you see some of that story coming true after the...
Totally. Yeah. My publisher says to me, how did you foresee this 35 years ago? Because like what I'm reading in the book, it's exactly what's unfolding now. And I go, how did that book disappear and then reappear? I have all kinds of questions and not so many answers. Yeah. I mean, you know, another interviewer asked me, he said, do you think, you know, E.T. erased it? You think E.T. messed with your computer to delay the coming of the book? And I go, that's a little, maybe that's a little step too far for me. I wouldn't say that's impossible. But I would need more evidence.
Yeah.
On that.
Is the book out now? Can people get it?
You can get it.
All that kind of stuff. Where's the best?
So it's on, there's a Kindle and there's a paperback. It's on Amazon and, you know, all the major places you can get a book. But it really has this beautiful cover, which my publisher works with this wonderful artist in China, a young woman who has a great vision. And I love all the little spaceships on the top. I don't know if you can see them all. Yeah. It's very clever because it has the book as part of the book cover. And anyway, yeah, the book is available. It's getting some good play. Thank you for being part of that. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Are you any plans to get on an audio at all? Audiobook?
I think we'll do one. Yeah. You know, they don't necessarily do them right away.
Yeah, you should.
But I get requests for that. Yeah. I have done audiobooks. I've written a lot of books at this point, and I have, you know, audio of some other ones. But, yeah, but this is the only one about aliens so far.
Can I ask you a Tai Chi question before we wrap it up?
Bring it on, baby.
Well, how did Tai Chi help with your healing? And also, it seems to be viral these days. I'm getting all these Instagram, like Tai Chi walking and all these people losing weight. And I'm getting sucked in and I'm trying to figure out if I tried Tai Chi walking or not.
Or should I just, you know, I'm very tempted. You know, we're on video, so I have to behave myself. There's a pollen or something in the room, a lot of dust. I don't know what it is, but it's making me sneeze. So look, I'll answer your question about Tai Chi, but I will also say that any time, you know, ancient things that have tremendous depth and knowledge to them are commercialized and put into the marketplace that we call American culture, anti-culture. You know, things are diluted tremendously, and that's, you know, that's going on with the walking. Tai Chi walking is a fabulous, fabulous exercise. And I would be happy to offer you, you know, we could do a Zoom and I can show you how to do it sometime. But, you know, the AI stuff that's going on there now with some ripped Asian guy, you know, who's 25 and has the body of an Adonis and takes his shirt off and says he's 150, you know, I don't know, whatever. All that stuff, not so much. And I guess Tai Chi is, first of all, it's a martial art, as I mentioned earlier. It's built on this tripod of Chinese medicine and Taoist philosophy and the folk martial arts, battlefield arts of the day. And it's very effective, but it's not a street fighting form. So you know, you asked me about the walking and the health. I mean, if I am known for practicing with a 9-foot spear and an 8-foot sword, you know, these are not practical. I don't go out, you know, when I go out to dinner, I don't take along my halberd, you know. These are not things that we study. When every granny has a Glock in her glove box and we have cruise missiles and nukes, you know, walking around with a halberd or a spear, maybe not the most practical idea, you know. But what it can help us with is the enemies that we have, which are very different from the old days now, which are the degenerative diseases of aging and, you know, the effects of stress in modern life, the phone addictions and the pace of things and our fragmented attention spans, our sedentary lives. And I think it, you know, it's fantastic for that. So I'll give you a super quick way of looking at it. In Chinese medicine, you could equate it to the garden irrigation system in your garden. So let's say you go out in your backyard and you notice that over there in the corner, you know, there's some flowers that aren't doing very well. They're all wilted. And you go up and you look at your little irrigation hoses and you find that something happened and the water isn't getting to them. So the hose is broken. There's a rock got in it somehow, or something is squishing the hose so the water, the flow is diminished. And if you want your flowers or your tree to flourish, you restore the flow of water doing whatever is required according to the damage or the problem. Our body is like the garden. And we have circulation, blood, lymph, interstitial fluid, nervous impulses, and so on. And our bodies, our organs, and everything out to our extremities, our brain, are nourished by this garden hose system. In Chinese medicine, it's about meridians and the flow of qi. In Western medicine, it's about the things I just mentioned. Tai Chi is a system for restoring the proper flow to all of those different systems for your maximum health and longevity. And the method that Tai Chi uses to do that is very unique and specific. And that method is spirals. So, for example, if you have a dish towel and it's full of water and you want to wring it out, you want to dry it, you can circle it above your head, you can shake it. But if you really want to dry the towel, if you want to move water, liquid, through a solid matrix, so blood or lymph through our bones and our ligaments and our tendons, our muscles, you wring the towel. And that's the most effective way to dry it, because that's the most effective way to get fluids through your matrix. Tai Chi works on that principle. If you are studying with a qualified teacher from the original stuff, you are learning how to spiral your body in ways that assure that your circulation is maximized. That's it in a nutshell. Of course, there's a whole lot more, philosophy, relaxation, and so on, but that's the gist.
And I know you don't need more students, but but if we send them to where's your website here? Monk Yun Ro. Oh, now I'm going to pronounce your name wrong. Yunro.com.
Perfect. Yeah, there's classes listed there, and I teach locally in Tucson, and I have a school in South Florida. I have students teaching there. It was quite a big school before I left Florida. And I have other students teaching around the country in various places. And I have an online class on Wednesday nights at 8 New York time. And all of those links are on the website. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good description.
This has been great. Thank you for coming on the show. And I look forward to maybe some more books, maybe some more sci-fi. It's, you know, it's a good genre. It's kind of all the same now these days. So we could use a shakeup.
I promise you the next one is not like anything you read. I'm working on it now.
Yeah, let's
Sure and share.
On. Yeah, come back on when you finish that one and we'll talk about it.
You got that.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you again for the invite.
Thank you.
Appreciate meeting you both and for your interest.
Absolutely. Thanks. Have a good day.
See you.
And that was our chat with Monk Yun Ro. What'd you think?
Oh, wow. I'm glad we did that. Holy, that blew me away.
I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah, I did not know that origin story either, which is fantastic. So. The
origin story. Not really a synchro, I guess, but it's something.
Yeah.
Not really a synchro. Big thanks to Monk Yun Ro for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you do choose to support the work. GrewAmerica.ca/support. We thank you for that. Couldn't do the show without you. Check out contactatthecabin.com for trips and events. Adultbrain.ca for the audiobooks. Disaster maps. Disastermap.ca and simulationmaps.com. Check that stuff out. And yeah, tell your friends about the show. That's the most important thing. Share the show with your friends. Help spread the hegemony. You're muted.
And the good vibes.
And the good vibes. We love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
Cigarettes, so profusely, so profusely.